Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to this week's episode of Safe Room, a horror video game podcast and proud member of Bloody Disgusting's Bloody FM podcast network. I'm your host, Jay Krieger.
And I'm the other one, Neil Bolt.
And this week, we're stepping out of the shadows ever so briefly to chat about Arkane Studios' 2012 BAFTA award winner, Dishonored, in which the player plays Corvo, a bodyguard turned revolutionary assassin who begins targeting members of the government responsible for killing his employer, Empress Caldwin, and kidnapping her daughter, Emily. So this, again, is, you know, one of those bucket list games that we're covering this week in terms of, you know, games that we both are massive fans of. Somehow this is my first playthrough of it. Don't hold that against me, but or my second playthrough, rather. But at the same time, like, this is one of those games that I think does such a good job at perhaps being resemblant of what Arkane Studios does so well, to a degree that, like, coming back to this game after, of course, playing some of Dishonored 2, but also playing the rest of their catalog in terms of more specifically something like Prey, even something like Deathloop, right? But coming back to Dishonored, I was surprised at just seeing how this game feels like the blueprint for so many other games that they would go on to make later on. And at the same time, seeing how they would evolve on some of the mechanics that were in the original Dishonored, or at least, you know, maybe some of the inclinations they have in terms of, like, the art style or the way that they want to build these worlds. Coming back to Dishonored all these years later, it doesn't feel like a lesser experience, so to speak, in terms, you know, sometimes when you come back to see the roots of a studio, sometimes those early games, you know, a lot of your impression of them or your memory of them is probably slightly marred by, like, nostalgia for it, right? That can tend to be something that happens. But with something like Dishonored, I was kind of blown away at just, like, how well this game holds up all these years later, even seeing how Arkane Studios would, you know, evolve on what was introduced with this. So I think I'd like to start with just, you know, for you, Neil, in terms of, like, Dishonored, what are sort of, like, the defining traits or qualities of this game that still make it a standout amongst their other games for you?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's the look of it. Is I mean, the art style is the Half-Life 2 artist Sebastian Mitten, isn't it? And, you know, you can tell, you know, in so many ways. I think that was one of the main draws when the game came out, was just seeing it and going, "Ooh, this has a very Half-Life vibe to it." And even, like, audio-wise, something about it, just, you know, the way noises are going on in the background, like, it just feels like a Valve game at times, but mixed with, like, something that, you know, the makers of Deus Ex would make, sort of thing, you know, like that, which is perfect. You know, that's the kind of thing you want. And yeah, so this sort of steampunk London sort of thing they've got going on as well, which, you know, London doesn't tend to get done all that well in games all that often. And while this is obviously a fictional country and all that and place, it still is very much based on that. And I like that because it is a very different kind of architecture to the rest of Europe that feels very distinct, and, you know, like that. I really did enjoy that visual style of it more than anything else. Everything else kind of opened up after that, you know, like the game it actually was is quite intimidating, you know, in a console space at that time. And still to this day is like, as you say, just really, really strong.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great starting point because, you know, for me, I had forgotten just how similar some of the aspects, kind of like what you'd mentioned about Half-Life 2, you know, this setting of Dunwall has such a City 17 feel to it while still drawing from, you know, that 19th, 20th century influence of London, Edinburgh, which they were, you know, drawing for their source of inspiration. And I think that what that allows is that you have this very, what seemingly from the outset is like this very brutalist, very sort of straightforward depiction of a city space. But at the same time, like it makes Dunwall feel a lot more approachable, I think, than it would be if you kind of led with the fact that, oh, this is actually one of the most versatile environments in games for that period. And I would say even, you know, nowadays still, this game world, you know, as much as it draws you in because of its aesthetics, old design, and, you know, just the overall art style, more importantly, you know, it has such an influence on the gameplay because of the freedom that that environment allows for. But I think, you know, you mentioned a moment ago something about how this world of Dunwall sort of has similarities to City 17 and in general, you know, Half-Life's approach to environments and whatnot in different settings from the sound design, right?
Yeah.
With Dunwall, like there are very specific sounds that are tied to very specific actions within the city in a way that it feels like it's in service of the player in the sense that it's giving them information about what is happening in an immediate area, which ultimately, you know, when you're this master tactician or as Corvo, like all of those factors come in to play. And it's a rare example, I think, of audio in a game not being overly abundantly apparent, I think, in an environment. Like there's not a lot going on, but everything that happens, the player is receiving some semblance of feedback. So whether it's like the propaganda that's blasting over the loudspeakers, which ultimately is expanding on sort of the lore, giving players an idea of like the plague time setting, the ramifications of that, why you don't see people, you know, out and about in the streets for the most part. But at the same time, like certain objects and items in the world have a sound that goes along with them, like the walls of light, which act as those barriers. That always gives the player a heads up like, oh, I hear that recharging or somebody put in a new jug of whale oil that's powering that. I need to be cognizant of that. At the same time, you can eavesdrop on, you know, enemy conversations, which goes past the point of just the typical banter of like, oh, on another patrol, this sucks kind of thing. We should go to the pub later. Like it goes past that because it actually ties into the note system for assassinations for most of the game, where it's like you can overhear little bits of dialogue that then will key you into clues that can help you get into other areas, maybe steer you in the direction of where you should be looking for like a key entry point or a key item or like a key relationship between NPCs that then will allow the player to kind of find that sort of path quicker to their target and whatnot. And that just ends up being an aspect of the audio design that, again, kind of reinforces this idea that when you're talking about an immersive sim, most of the time you would hope that all the aspects of design are tied into that nature. But that doesn't always end up being the case. And I think that, you know, again, talking about the fact that Viktor Antonov, who designed Half-Life 2 City 17, being at the helm of this, was so integral to just the overall approach to environmental design. But at the same time, you know, of course, Arkane Austin, and I believe a fraction of the staff was made up of ex-like Looking Glass employees, so, you know, Thief Games and whatnot. So like pairing those two worlds of game design really just made for, you know, what I would say is like the blueprint for what you would want for an immersive sim game in, you know, more ways than one, seemingly all aspects of design.
Yeah. Yeah. It does just pull from different areas of that sort of PC space, you know, where innovation was really happening in a gameplay sense and you had this freedom. You know, you look back to early games in a lot of that time, you know, people always going about Morrowind, for instance, being like the height of that series in terms of its flexibility and freedom. You know, the original Deus Ex, which, you know, to this day is still like remarkable how open and complex it is for a game of its age, arguably more so than the games that came later, which were still really good. And this and Deus Ex Human Revolution were around about a year apart, I think. I think Human Revolution was 2011. And they both coming to the console space at that time was a really important thing, because I think they did the right thing in sort of softly making it a bit more approachable whilst giving you all the tools to really get into what it could do. You know, the big difference between this and its sequel is that in the sequel you can do New Game Plus and accumulate all the powers and really trick yourself out and try all different things to approach the game, where it's just, it is very much designed with the idea that you cannot get everything in a single playthrough. You have to, you know, just mix and match and pick and choose depending on your playthrough, which that's how you get your replay value. It's like you try this approach this time, that approach to the other time. I mean, like, that's great. Yeah, like, it gives you such flexibility in that regard, you know, that you don't really mind that you don't get that, I suppose, that you don't get this sort of New Game Plus vibe. But still, it is a game designed in a very specific way to cater to everyone at that time, you know, like about, you know, 10, 12 years ago. So, yeah, I think it's done a grand job there, you know, as well.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there was something interesting I read, was that when they were designing the world of Dunwall and all these different environments and sections of the city, the starting point was always like viewing it from a rat's point of view.
Yeah.
Which I just, you know, that plague setting in general is just something that I love and I'm kind of infatuated with ever since re-diving into the Darkest Dungeon series and whatnot. And just, you know, the whole plague aspect of that on top of, you know, just in general, like having sort of like this love affair with alternative history fiction, and the fact that, you know, this draws in sort of like this steampunk aspect, but at the same time, there's this like weird whale oil powered tech in this world and whatnot. And it's just cool to see, you know, taking a setting that at face value seems familiar, but there's just something slightly off about it, which again was a quality of City 17 and Half-Life 2, where it's like, oh, this looks very much like the brutalist architecture of a country like Poland or something like that. But there's these massive metal walls up and then these towers and these sort of like force fields and whatnot. And so to see that here, you know, immediately was just like, oh yeah, this is why I love this game. And this is kind of like bringing me back to this game that, you know, takes a familiar setting to be the entry point, but then the ways in which they're able to kind of like make it slightly off from what you're expecting. If anything, it just makes it that much more unique and interesting, which, you know, while I'll say now, like the story of this game is not one of my favorite aspects of it, but at the same time, the world itself feels so rich with lore.
Yes.
In a way that, you know, you mentioned Morrowind. Morrowind's one of those games where it's like through exploring this massive world and the narrative and the sort of lore and books, and you find like, that's a world that I love. And then coming to Dishonored, you know, reading all these texts that you can find, whether it's talking about the sort of new economy, the way in which the plague started, the ramifications for that, and the people that were kind of acting behind the scenes, at the same time, this like weird whale tech and whatnot, and how they have this whole economy built around that and whatnot. Like, it makes for a world that is a lot richer the deeper the player invests into it, which I think, you know, talking about an immersive sim, those are the most rewarding games because, you know, before we get into the nitty gritty of like gameplay, carrying out assassinations, like the act of the assassination itself is the least rewarding part of the game, but it's all, it's, you know, the 85% leading up to that assassination is what I find to be the most enriching part of this. And that is a game that genuinely, it feels like, lets the player go. You get, you know, a couple of hints and tidbits and whatnot, but even the first time you run through any mission, you're basically just scratching the surface. No matter if your inclination as a player is to like, okay, I want to seek out the most complex route, I want to explore the most, or I just want to get to the assassination, headshot somebody and get out as quickly as possible. Like, the fact of the matter is that each of those assassinations has so much depth to it. And it's not this typical thing that you see a lot of the time where it's like, well, you can either go into this mission loud or you could go and do it quiet. Like, Dishonored has such this great middle ground, I think, of an experience where it's like, you could do that. You could go loud or you could go silent, but like at the same time, there's no right or wrong way to go through it because of the fact you get all these different pathways, you get all these different abilities that really do give players at the time an unprecedented level of freedom, I think.
Yeah, and I think we'll get down to it later that, you know, the evolution of that has been seen in so many games since, you know, like that kind of the journey to the target thing being the flexible part, and that's where it's fun. You know, the games I will most obviously reference being games like Hitman and Metal Gear Solid 5, which just did fantastic things with that, and even Arcane again with the later games. But I thought before we did get into that, it's also worth mentioning that, like, this is one hell of a stacked cast as well in this game. You're like, it always strikes me, you know, how, like, whoa, this cast is, you know. You have Chloe Grace Moretz, you know, and here is Emily. You have the one that always makes me laugh is that despite her short role in it, Jessamine Goldwyn being played by April Stewart, who's pretty much like, if there's a female voice on South Park, that's her, so sort of thing like that. There's weird little things like that. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's the whole famous story about, like, you can replace the Tannoy announcer by getting them out, killing them, and Carrie Fisher takes over, and that's the only way you'd find out that she was in the game, sort of thing. But yeah, the guy who does do it is like Odie in the Garfield animated series, like that. So it's just weird things like that. But then you have like Lena Headey, you have Brad Dourif, you know, Chucky, you know, as a nice character. John Slattery, who I think is Mad Men, isn't he? And yet, I think the one that always just throws me for a complete loop is Susan Sarandon as Granny Rags. Which, again, something you can see a little or a lot of, depending on how you play. And, you know, and Michael Madsen, you know, who does get his own sort of DLC as well. And he's been quite an effective one, you know, doing voice work in games over the years. It's like when in that period. So, yeah, he just suits the kind of characters he ends up picking. But yeah, he is just ridiculous, that cast, you know. And to this day, it's, I think there's been one that's been better. You know, I think the sequel had some famous names, but I think it was anywhere near you know. Oh, and the one thing that always makes me laugh as well, Sokolov being Roger Jackson, who is of course the voice of Ghostface in Scream as well. It's just so many nuts one. Yeah, every time you look at it, go down that list, there's always someone. But yes, I had to get in that in there because I just it's one of those things I can never quite get past with this game.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because I think that it, and it's funny that I'm replaying Dishonored while I'm playing through the new Alone in the Dark game, because these are two polar opposite examples of how to properly use, you know, famous voice actors. Because in my opinion, playing through Alone in the Dark, it's a game that has two well-known actors,
yeah,
two actors that also has, you know, their facial features in it. And it feels like a complete kind of shrug, the fact that you have real actors in that game, the fact that they look the part and whatnot.
Yeah.
I find their utilization to be distracting and to not really add anything to it, as opposed to if it was just, you know, two unknowns or two lesser known,
yeah,
voice actors. Whereas in Dishonored, the laundry list of well-known actors that you just mentioned, I don't find to be distracting at all, to the degree that I didn't know about half of them until I went through and read the Wikipedia, because of the fact they're able to elevate source material while not, I suppose, now I can't not hear their voice, but it's like they don't leave such an overt or distracting stamp on those roles in a fashion that you just say, oh, well, it's just Brad Dourif doing a variation of Chucky or something along those lines, right? It feels like somebody that took in the source material and then at the same time was able to produce something at, you know, their very high skill level, but it doesn't feel like they're just drawing from something they've already done or something that they're so well known for that,
yeah,
that's all you hear from the outset.
Yeah, and I think if you've ever seen the NoClip documentary on the making of Dishonored, which is great if you haven't, do, because it is really insightful. But yeah, you do get the sense in that that the voices, you know, the famous people were kind of pushed upon them, you know, that they didn't really want to have so many people. But and it did seem odd that, you know, this game from this company that weren't really big at that point were getting such a stacked cast, but still, it was... But like you said about like finding out names the way you do, I think with that Brad Dourif one, I was like, it wasn't him I thought of first. And I searched the name specifically because I thought it was Christopher Randolph, who voices Otacon in the Metal Gear series, like that, because it sounded so similar to that. I thought that that's the role would make sense as too, but yeah. And then to find out it wasn't, it was Brad Dourif, which is like, yeah, that's crazy.
Now, whenever I think about like famous actors in a game, the first thing I think about is like any Kojima game.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's the idea where he's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna try to get all my friends, all my favorite movie stars into a game, and you know, get their voice, but at the same time do facial capture and motion capture with them and stuff like that. But at the same time, going back to some older games and just being able to appreciate the fact that you had professional actors from films come in and they really are able to add something to performances, even if this, you know, the material itself is kind of run of the mill, I would suppose, in terms of like, oh, this is that, you know, the bodyguard that's now an assassin who's trying to get revenge because, you know, his charge was kidnapped or something along those lines, which, you know, is a pretty run-of-the-mill sort of narrative. But the fact that you're able to have these characters that have very limited interactions with one another, only in between missions, but still have them be memorable in a way that, you know, you might not have with other voice actors or who knows. It's just the type of thing where it's like, it's nice to see examples from back in the day where you had these big Hollywood names that didn't just feel overly distracting.
Yeah.
Because that's my one thing now where it's just like, when I look at some games, primarily, you know, what's in the back of my mind is the new Alone in the Dark. It's just like, it kind of just feels distracting. And it feels like maybe that budget could have been spent somewhere else because I don't necessarily think that having those bigger names adds much weight to it. Whereas with Dishonored, having those big names involved, certainly I think leaves a better lasting impression with these characters in terms of the sort of, I suppose, conviction with which they are selling a story that I've more or less heard time and time again.
And, you know, if you do look at that list of people in it, many of them do have a background in voice acting somewhere. You know, even when you go to stuff like Carrie Fisher and Michael Madsen, they've done it. Even Susan Sarandon has done it. And, you know, I said stuff like Gabriel Stewart and Roger Jackson, you know, obvious people who've done stuff like that before. So, and Brad Dourif, you know, famously, you know, does voice work for a character a lot. But so, yeah, I think at least it was built with that in mind by the look of it as well. You know, actors who are comfortable on either side of it and understand it, which is probably why it stands out as being not standing out, you know?
It's amazing. Yeah. Oh, in Brad Dourif's case, too, this one, he is a little more elegant in his delivery than Chucky.
Yeah, I don't think he threatens to kill anyone with a mouthful of expletives even once. So.
But I guess before we take a break and we dive into sort of the nitty-gritty of gameplay and the immersive sim nature of Dishonored, I did just want to talk very briefly about the graphics for this game, or more specifically, the art style of this game. Now, I replayed the Definitive Edition, which I believe has somewhat of a graphical boost. And on top of the fact I'm playing it on Xbox Series X, so there's, of course, an FPS boost and little cosmetic upgrades and whatnot. But just the art style in general is probably one of my favorites because of the fact that, you know, all the characters and ostensibly the world itself has this like oil painting sort of look to it, which I think, you know, a more modern example, that would be something probably along the lines of like Disco Elysium.
Yes.
But here, the fact that, you know, you have that first person perspective, the player can go wherever they want, whenever they want. And, you know, you get those really great sort of close-ups when you're interacting with characters that really show off that fantastic art style of the character models and their faces. But then once that contrasts against those environments that have so much depth to them, or I suppose they feel, I don't know, they feel like they have the depth of a painting almost. There's just some quality about that that so perfectly fits that 19th, 20th century England, Edinburgh kind of influence of the world itself.
Yeah.
That, you know, it made me kind of savor every interaction with characters because there's not a lot of them. So the fact that you get to actually, you know, slow down when you go back to your sort of hub world in between assassinations, interact with characters was just like a nice way to sort of, again, kind of reinforce just how pretty this game looks.
It does. And I think what I find quite interesting when you go from game to game, from, you know, there's a sort of through line in terms of how that art style shifts and changes depending on what it is. Like with Dishonored 2, where it feels a bit more European, beyond like the UK sort of area, you know, there's a slight shift in how that painting style looks more, it takes on a more European sort of aesthetic. Particularly, there's like an Italian sort of Frenchish nature to it at times. And you know, I think Prey, where you know, it, I can't remember the painter, but there's like it's a very specific sort of futuristic painter, you know, someone who paints like futuristic vistas and things like that. Again, it's still technically that same sort of paintbrush look, but it's modernized in some way. It has that sort of 60s. I really wish I'd remembered the name of this guy, but yeah, it's like a very distinct look, and it still feels like, and even Deathloop to a degree, yeah, which obviously goes very the big pop 60s style stuff. Yeah, you know, so I love that that's at the forefront. I think because it's one of those games where it's from concept art onwards, it ends up kind of looking the same, you know, because so much detail goes into these worlds in terms of like making them feel like these things you can move through in any which way. You know, it's the detail has to be there, and I think it just sort of ends up staying the further they go along.
Yeah, I think that for my money, like Arkane is one of those studios that it feels like they're drawing from, you know, Dishonored largely as the basis for like their approach with their art design and their art direction with their games. And the fact that they're able to draw influence from the era with which they are, you know, operating in, but at the same time, they're able to have these little oddball sort of technology or environmental things that just the way in which they're able to sort of superimpose them into the world themselves, they feel so at home in a way that doesn't feel nearly as jarring as perhaps it did in like City 17. You know, walking out of the train station for the first time and you see this world and you can see the apartments in the background, but then you see this massive, you know, sci-fi walls and force field and sort of the main tower or citadel in the background. It's like, oh, this is very clearly a sci-fi world. But I find that with, you know, Dishonored and then of course Prey and whatnot, like they have such a way of easing you into the world and leading with the fact that, you know, okay, this is the setting, 1920 influence or the future setting or the 60s kind of weird sci-fi setting. They have such an even hand, I think, with introducing these worlds that end up being very jarring and whatnot because of this sort of strangeness in them and whatnot. But it's all in good time, which I think is almost an art form in and of itself, of getting players invested in a world, making it a world that they could see themselves being in. And then once they feel somewhat comfortable, that's when you hit them over the head with the truly wild aspects of the technology for this, you know, fantasy setting and whatnot. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into the nitty gritty of the immersive sim nature of Dishonored. And of course, we'll chat about some of those memorable assassination missions and whatnot. But more on that in a moment. And we are back from our break, and we're going to dive right into the immersive sim nature of this game. And, you know, I'm going to start off by doing something that I hate doing because I would never want anybody to look at a piece of writing or anything that I said on a podcast 10 plus years later. But I was, before this, was watching a video review that IGN did for Dishonored when it came out. And in that, the review opens with, what did they say? They said, the reviewer states, there hasn't been a shooter with as much freedom as Dishonored since the original BioShock, which, first off, this game is not a shooter.
I mean,
and second, the idea that you would think that the linear and claustrophobic sinking toilet of Rapture is constructed with player freedom in mind is a stretch. And I'm going to leave it at that because that's one of those things that it's like, it almost is a fundamental misunderstanding of what immersive sims are. And the reason that I'm opening with this is the fact that, you know, we talked a lot about the world of Dunwall, but the actual construction of Dunwall, I think, is, again, one of the most impressive examples of a game world environment because of the fact that, you know, you might look at it in the opening moments of a mission and say, I'm sure that there's one or two pathways. And the fact that Dunwall in every environment that you're going to explore has layers upon layers upon layers. It's like 100-layer lasagna almost of assassination in that it's like you can go underwater. You can go through the sewers. You can go up onto, you can teleport onto this rooftop. You can go through this abandoned building, but it's so much more than that because you never, as the player, feel restricted in any way.
No.
And that, again, is such a it's such a remarkable thing for a game that's an immersive sim, because, you know, half of the time when a game claims to be an immersive sim, there's maybe two or three pathways. But Dishonored is one of those games where, again, your first playthrough, it's almost like you might as well not even count it as a first playthrough, yeah, because of the fact that you're only going to begin to peel back those layers of complexity to the world and the player's abilities on maybe your second or your third playthrough of the game.
Yeah, sorry, my eyebrows are probably still raised from that Bioshock comparison. Yeah, which is a shame, because I think the first part of that is actually an interesting point, that I could see how someone comes into having played it a certain way and think, yeah, it's an intelligent shooter because of the way you can play it in that way, where it is very flexible and you end up fluffing your lines a lot and having to shoot your way out of trouble sometimes. But so, yeah, in that sense, it probably feels like amazing in that, if you're talking in a shooter sense. But yeah, the comparison point was maybe a bit, would speak to a very small pool of experience on that front. But still, yeah, now the initial shock has gone. It's fine. Yeah, but this is such an interesting set of design rules. Like I said, simplifying some of the stuff that had come before, making the most of the technology we have at that time, and really just creating each space in a way that is, you know, just making it in them levels effectively, and not like making it one big world like they eventually end up doing with their games. It's definitely, generally, with the exception of Prey, I suppose, it's the way I really like Arkane games, when they are quite in this sort of segmented thing where you are like, here's a section, back to the hub, here's a section, you know, the spoken wheel thing, isn't it? You know, where you're like,
mm-hmm.
It works like that so well, because so much dedication and effort and craft is put into each individual stage and making it the right thing. And again, it's why Dishonored 2 against is marvelous, what it does. The stuff in that game, forget about it. You know, I'm sure we'll come on to that another time, but you know, when you have something like the Clockwork Mansion and just the way that works, you know, it blows my mind, you know, that to this day. And this is obviously very much simpler in what it does, but still, it's the verticality. Yeah, you know, I love that word for a game, but it really does just have the verticality where it's like, you're not just like, can you go forward? Can you run? No, it's like, you can fucking go top to bottom and approach it from all these different angles. And that in itself, on that, you know, that blink ability instantly is like, you know, for me, it's like the iconic move for the whole game. You know, it's like, it's the one thing you need to really use to begin with, and it really stays with you and it affects the way you do everything, you know, like that. It's important because you can literally just teleport up behind someone at a distance and just take them out quietly if you do it quick enough. And or you can, yeah, just teleport down into someone and do the same. It's just, and getting across spaces without being seen when you upgrade it enough. And yeah, it is just fascinating to see, you know, to go back to from playing it once, twice, three times and seeing how you could approach it differently and seeing entirely new things in these places you think you've explored completely, you know, like that, where you're sure that, oh, I went to every single room in this place and I knew all that. It's like, it's because if you do things in a certain way, you could miss entire aspects of it, which is just shows you all the sort of stuff working behind the scenes in these games.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioning the blink, the teleport ability is one of those things where it's like, to have an ability that has multiple functions for the player, whether it be combat oriented, whether it be environmental traversal oriented, like that is a testament to people that understand if you're going to have an immersive sim, almost every single thing that the player can do needs to have more purpose than just one,
yeah,
or the other. And the fact that, you know, something as versatile as the blink ability that can, you know, be a pro in combat, and at the same time, it's, you know, imperative to environmental traversal, it ends up being the one thing that when I come back, I immediately just like put all my runes into upgrading that as quickly as, yes, possible, because of the fact that, you know, you're going to be using that probably almost as much as your sword. But at the same time, like the quicker that you level that up, it makes you not only more efficient in combat, but it allows you to explore that world in a lot more depth, I suppose, right? Because all of a sudden, if I teleport farther, then I can immediately, you know, access some of these abandoned buildings that previously I couldn't if I only had the sort of like initial blink ability. And so, you know, from that aspect, it ends up introducing this really great quality of all the powers where it allows the player to prioritize what's important to them. At the same time, you never feel like, oh, I made the wrong choice when you spend runes, because a majority of the powers have such versatility to them. Because sometimes when you have games that are either RPGs or they try to adapt or include RPG mechanics and functionality, such as a game like Dishonored, when you start dumping like points into certain abilities, I at least have the issue where sometimes like an hour in, I'm like, well, I don't really enjoy using those abilities. So all of a sudden I've wasted points into something that I'm not going to use again. Now, of course, the modern day concession to that is you can typically reroll your stats, but you still have spent an hour with points into an ability that doesn't end up being utilized as much as you thought it would be. And in Dishonored, I find that's never the case because of the fact that you have that first level of an ability that allows the player to have this new ability. But then more importantly, when you upgrade it, it gives you, you know, either an increased duration of that ability, or it gives you like a sub ability to that, or it just bolsters what you could already do with that first level. And so in a game that is all about player choice, to have the world be crafted almost with those powers in mind, again, is just one of those things where I come back to like Dishonored is the blueprint for, you know, immersive sims in that regard, where it's like, I suppose I should have the caveat, modern immersive sims, right? Because of course, Dishonored is learning from, you know, two decades of immersive sims before it. But more importantly, you know, and I think if anything, you know, you'd mentioned the importance of Dishonored being a console game in addition to, of course, being a PC game. The fact that, you know, we didn't typically have a lot of immersive sims on consoles because of technical limitations and things like that. You know, Deus Ex has already been mentioned. A perfect example of when that game came to console, it was much more linear than the original Deus Ex. I think it was Deus Ex Invisible War that came out on Xbox and PC. And that game as a whole limited player freedom because they had to make an experience that would play similarly on PC and Xbox. You're not going to have the original Deus Ex on the original Xbox at that point in time. And so in 2012 with Dishonored, it being a console game in addition to a PC game, but the technology had finally caught up that players had that freedom because of the technical capabilities of modern consoles at that period, you know, that just makes for this almost, you know, eye-opening experience, I feel like, for people that are primarily console players. You get this world that drops you in with very little hand-holding, and you essentially have the freedom to utilize these various variables in any way you see fit. And for the most part, it doesn't feel like there are any wrong decisions in that regard that the player can make, because everything is beneficial in one way or another.
Yeah.
And in multiple ways.
Yeah. To just go back to that as well, when you're saying about Deus Ex, interestingly, I remember it being made for the PS2. And even then, there were so many things they had to change. You know, that it was a retooled version, you know, where they had to cut some things out. You know, it did not run well, unsurprisingly. Yeah, and I think it had mouse and keyboard support because it was a struggle to sort of play on a controller. Yeah,
sure.
So yeah, but yeah, it was done, but it was very difficult to do it. I think it came like two, three years after the game came out on PC as well. But yeah, it just shows you how difficult it was to do that. That weird, wonderful period where PC games that really shouldn't be on console did, and the efforts could be very good. You know, I think most of the time they were a bit unpalatable. And that was definitely one of them where it was like, this was definitely a lot better on PC to play.
I guess in terms of us like talking about the versatility of powers and the abilities that Corvo has, like for you, what is your inclination, I suppose, as a would-be assassin when you go into a run of this game? How do you typically lean in terms of which powers do you prioritize? What equipment do you prioritize? And are you more of a silent takedown person, or are you more of a chaotic individual, kind of like myself.
With every stealth game ever, it's a case of I'll try until I can't, sort of thing.
From the same cloth in that regard.
That's it, which, like I said, is one of the things I prefer about Dishonored 2, in the sense that you can come back to it with more and more powers and have a more rounded set of things to do, because then you can play it completely differently. I like to do that in here and try and start with different powers, different things. But there's some stuff you just find difficult to let go of sometimes. Shadow kill being one of the main things, you know, like turns the enemies to ash like that. But that does mean you have to kill them. You know, I mean, the system is the chaos system in this, which isn't like about being, it's not morality in that sense. You know, your actions do cause changes in the world, but the world's fucked either way in its own right. So all you're doing is affecting small parts of it. And what's going on around there, it basically ups the amount of like the weepers, you know, the people who are infected with the plague but not dead, sort of thing, who show up in the levels and stuff. And yeah, so you're not really being sort of looked down upon to be high chaos and being right, you know, badass about it. It's just the consequence of that is that you will use up more stuff. You will find yourself in hairy situations a lot quicker. And getting out can be a lot harder. But it's always having to have that sort of balance when I first start. Is that I will end up using, you know, Blink, obviously you have. But Devouring Swarm, Shadow Kill, like the three things. Like just to make things go away, to make this easier, keep the run going, like that. Always concentrating on getting that crossbow as well sorted as possible. Because it is just, you know, so effective. And I try not to use the gun, mainly because gunplay is like very much a last resort, and I find in this game that you don't really want to be relying on it at all if you don't have to. Again,
the gun was basically like regulated for me for dealing with weepers in those sewer sections, because it's like you don't have to worry about alerting guards for the most part. You get swarmed by them. It's like, okay, I've upgraded this enough. I get more than one shot in it. So it's not just this like useless blunderbuss, basically.
Yeah.
And then just like mowing through them. But yeah, no, it's one of those things where it's like I go in with the best of stealthy intentions. But as soon as something sort of devolves, it's like, oh, OK, we're going to get chaotic as hell right now. And I'm going to utilize Swarm, basically, which, you know, in this second playthrough, I was thinking to myself that I was like, I don't necessarily know that Dishonored is a difficult game from a traditional stealth viewpoint because of how forgiving it can be, right? Which I think is actually not a knock against it. I think from somebody like me, that's actually a positive. The fact that even if, you know, your best laid out plan falls apart, people are alerted, you know, there's a heightened sense of awareness from the other surrounding enemies. At the same time though, like that speaks to me as a game that is again, all in on player choice, because you can't punish a player for not playing a game, I suppose in air quotes, the ideal way that you would play a stealth game, and giving them a certain amount of leeway, even if at the end of the day, it's like, you can basically brute force your way out of anything. That's not the worst sort of outcome, because it ends up being fun still because of the powers and the weapons that are at the player's disposal.
Yes. It just makes it a little harder for you down the road, I think, basically. Yeah. Where if you haven't got into the rhythm of trying to be stealthy at all, some of those later sections are, you know, war every time you walk into them, especially as you get to that final mission and all that. It really does require you to be doing a good mix of things like that. So yeah, I think always somehow, the first, any time I return to this game, the first playthrough is that sort of mixed art sort of vibe, and then trying something a bit different. So I don't tend to worry about dark vision as much as I used to. Like the first time I did, because I used to get paranoid about like not being able to see things around corners. I just couldn't deal with that. Now, I think it's mainly because, you know, when it comes to sound for me, I have to be able to, if I can't hear things in the proper direction, I need some sort of indicator of where things are going. But once you get used to the systems, that's not as necessary, I think, if you don't want to. And then the wind blast I always end up getting into towards the end, because it's quite useful as you get to fight more enemies. And even if you're playing somewhat more passively, it's good to just sort of get some enemies out your way to get moving again, sort of thing. I like the possession thing. Like in both games, it's one of the things I didn't really do at all. until the like second, third playthrough. And then you play it and you go, oh, so this would have been really cool, actually. You're like, I mean, fucking hell, the madness, some of that stuff with the possession stuff is just ridiculous. And again, one of those systems that you look at it and go, where Prey sort of adapted it and did it different ways, it's like, it's something that feels like it shouldn't work. But then you routinely see aspects of it in games as simple as Call of Duty, you know, and like prop hunt and stuff. So it's not out of the way, you know, it's doable. It's just, it feels like magic in its own way. And yeah, so I think, yeah, you're right. All the abilities have something to them and all contribute. It's just having to let go of your personal preferences and things like that and just not falling into the temptation of, well, I'll take this thing on this mission because this is the thing I like, and you know, like, I'll make sure I've got all of these bits and bobs. There's a few games I do that where, you know, I'll play a lot, like the aforementioned Call of Duty, you know, that'll be like, I kind of can't do this without a submachine gun, must have a submachine gun. That sort of thing like that. It's always okay. So yeah, you get that, and you and I think Metal Gear Solid 5, where it's like, always have to have a trank gun of some kind just in case, because yeah, sometimes that's easier. And yeah, I like that. Systems that maybe don't punish you for trying to stay on the same lane by giving you encouragement in other areas, you know, it's like it allows you to experiment in stages, if you will, like that, to get you to the next stage. You know, I think most of my favorite games when it comes to replayability have some kind of aspect of that, where it's like you can play it the easy way the first time, and then gradually, the more you play it, the more you learn about it, the more different things you do in it. And that's why they become the games you love, because you know, suddenly they are this thing that has just kept rewarding you time and again. It's not a one and done, you've seen everything here, Jack, sort of thing. You are getting, you know, spoonfuls every time.
No, well said, because, you know, for me, this time around, I put more runes into the Wind Blast ability, which the first time I played this game, I didn't use at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, my hesitation initially was, okay, other than knocking over an enemy, which gives me a moment of reprieve, or, you know, you find that sort of little set piece moment where you're exploring the outer rim of an area and it's like, oh, there's a guy standing at the edge of a cliff or the edge of a bridge. It's like, yeah, you can throw him off with that or something. It's like, outside of those moments, how useful is this ability? And the fact that, you know, I looked into it a little bit more, which helps, utilizing that ability, not only in combat, but in environmental traversal, the fact that you can blow through doors when it's heavily upgraded, like all of a sudden, oh, this became a key, essentially like a key ability, sometimes. And so like, again, the fact that there is this duality to seemingly most abilities where it's like, it serves a purpose in combat, serves a purpose perhaps defensively, but it could also just be environmental traversal. It makes it that much more rewarding when you have a game that rewards in multiple ways, because you learn about different combos or different utilizations for those powers. At the same time, when I use that Wind Blast, if a horde of guys ran up to me, I would, you know, knock them over with that, which stuns them. I would run around a corner and place a couple of razor wires. And then all of a sudden, you know, that gives me some breathing room while they, you know, run to the fray of this trap that I've just set for them. And, in, you know, in mentioning the razor wire, it's one of those things where it's like, when I play the original, I almost wish that they had gotten a little bit weirder with the tech at Corvo's disposal. Yeah. Not that he has a lack of it. You know, while having a beating heart, the closer you get to those runes that's wrapped in like barbed wire and it's got metal in it and whatnot, it's like weird as fuck. I wish that there was a little bit more of the steampunk sort of tech at his disposal outside of a pistol, a crossbow, which is a ton of fun to use with the different types of bolts you can use. But also like the razor wire is super cool. I just wish that, and I can't remember because I didn't play enough of Dishonored 2, but just seeing ways in which Corvo's actual gear could be more reflective of, I suppose, the world itself in a sort of quirky way was one of those things where I was just like, I'm kind of just got like this crossbow and my sword is old reliable for the most part, because I'm not using grenades and, you know, the pistol all that much. But at the same time, you don't want to have this overabundance of gear at his disposable, I assume, because, you know, thinking about how versatile everything is, everything's got two or three utilizations.
Yeah.
So you really don't actually need that much, I suppose.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, making everything useful is just the fun thing about arcane games. So again, I think of Prey, and that, you know, that foam gun, foam dart launcher, like the fact that it's good for like hitting buttons and stuff like that through certain areas. It's like silently. I love that. Yeah, just the fact that it feels completely useless, but it's there and it has a purpose, sort of thing. And yeah, you've got things like that. I mean, throwing stuff, you know, and it's just a great set of systems that allows you to sort of go, yeah, you could do a little bit of this, you could do a little bit of that. And yeah, you aren't missing out if you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that gets us into what might end up being the brunt of our chat, considering we've almost been chatting for an hour now, but like the memorable hits in this game. It's one of those things where it's like, again, I said earlier, the actual act of the assassination itself, you're not fighting for the most part any, you know, super complex combat encounters with enemies. It's all about the journey getting to the assassination. But that doesn't end up being an issue because of the fact that in Dishonored, I find that a majority of the journey of getting to an assassination in a given mission is so goddamn memorable. So for you, like, what is a mission that stands out to you the most in terms of hits?
You know, it's been flexible and changed, I think, with time. And I actually, the one that's been most probably reviled recent years is, you know, after you get drugged and left in the old sunken area of town with Dowd, and you have, you know, you're basically having to build your way back up to your abilities. It's such a horrible trope in games, I know, where it's like, oh, you've lost your abilities and now you've got to get through this section. In most games, that would be fucking annoying. Yeah, that's true. But because of the way Dishonored is designed, it feels like a fresh challenge again, you know, to get to that point and know that, yeah, you can technically do that whole thing without going back and getting your equipment as well. You just, you know, just use the things you pick up. And so it feels like a bottle episode in this whole thing where you are just doing everything you've learned, but with an even smaller skill set like that. And that for me was just like, this time around, especially, it was like, yeah, you know what, this is a lot better than it was given credit for. And I understand why people hated the idea of like losing everything and having to navigate all that stuff. But yeah, I just think it's so intense, you know, in a way that up to that point, you're just getting comfortable with your powers and getting, you know, and feeling a bit cocky about your abilities. And then to sort of strip it away from you again with people who've got similar abilities to you makes it all the more interesting. And yes, I think, and also when you factor in the DLC with Dowd as well, it really does just flesh that whole thing out and just makes it a lot more interesting as a part of the story. So yeah, I love that. Plus, I think at the end of that one is where you can take a change in direction when you're getting out of the sewers, and that's where you find the end of the Granny Rag stuff if you've done the earlier stuff with her and the, was it the gang leader, like that, where she basically asks you to help her cook him effectively like that, or not, you know, like that, and you know, different rewards for different things, sort of thing. But yeah, and that was something I didn't discover until like this time, like that, which was amazing just by just sheer exploration. So yeah, it's just, for me, has become like my favorite mission in terms of doing that now, but in terms of like the hit and who it is and the consequences around it. That's probably because the ideas behind the killings, you know, it's very much as, or there's always the crafty, tricky way of killing people otherwise, like that. And, you know, there's a second option of this one where you can obviously leave Dowd. And he's, yeah, even that is one of the strongest ones because he's just kind of like baffled why you would let him go, sort of thing. Like, yeah. And you know, it's after everything he's done, and you know, as you learn through the DLC, you know, there's a lot of guilt in what he had to do. So yeah, it to me is like, yeah, definitely the highlight from both a narrative and a mechanical sort of standpoint.
Well, I think that that's one of my favorite missions that I don't think I truly appreciated the first time I played the game, because of the fact that by that point in the game, you know, of course, for the most part, you have your abilities upgraded to the nines. You've got a pretty good inventory, you know, more or less. have a pretty good pockets full of cash and whatnot for if you need to resupply. And while having all of those things stripped from the player is, you know, a trope of games, at the same time, you also are fighting a lot tougher enemies at that point. You're fighting other enemies that have similar abilities to you, which fundamentally shifts the sort of pacing of combat. Because I think up until that point, for the most part, the player is probably pretty overly confident in terms of their abilities, and they've mastered those threats. So all of a sudden, when you're facing foes and you're playing a game that, while it does not have this punishing penalty for being revealed or, you know, making your presence known, all of a sudden it becomes a little bit more punishingly because of the fact you're fighting enemies that can blink. They can at the same time use the crossbow, or I think they can even use the like phosphorus bolts or something along those lines. And all of a sudden it kind of just like throws the player off of their axis of what they're anticipating. And on top of the fact that you're playing in this environment that has, you know, a less than traditional verticality, even when you're talking about a game that is very vertical, the enemies can be anywhere because of the fact that they can blink. And at the same time, you're dealing with more of the weepers in that area, and you're dealing with some of those like parasitic plants that are spitting acid at you and whatnot. And so like the flooded district ends up being this culmination of what the game has basically been building up towards in a way, in terms of skill level. And I think that for me, that's what makes that an area that I really enjoyed more on my playthrough, just because of the fact that I was not only playing through the game in a shorter time crunch, so I was sort of refamiliarizing myself with the mechanics, getting at a certain point almost, I would say, overly confident, and then all of a sudden being reminded, oh, hey, by the way, you're about to deal with people that can do similar things to you. It was like a nice leading up to the conclusion sort of point where it's just like, okay, I need to check myself a little bit and, you know, have the same level of caution that I had in the beginning of the game, which is not always the case. And while, you know, say what we will about the conclusion of the game, that ends up being a chapter that I think reinforces, sure, we're going to reward player freedom and we're going to give players the ability to play this game the way they want to. But at the same time, you're going to have this next level of sort of combat challenge that doesn't just have a boss that has, you know, triple your health bar or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's it. I think by showing us this sort of other side of the place, you know, the real side of what's been left with everything that's going on like that in that area, it really does just drive home how different things are. Again, much like the sequel does when you go to certain areas, like the dust area, and it's just, you know, sad, you know, how it's changed, and you know, the power dynamic is what it is because of what's not been done by the people in charge. I mean, obviously, from a technical standpoint, there are great missions and areas, like, you know, the Lady Boyle bowl thing is still, you know, good. The most Hitman mission in terms of, like, your target could be any one of these people, and you've got to learn this information. You know, I like that from that standpoint, and the fact that it's random every time. And just the little sub-stories in there. And, you know, the Golden Cat mission as well, which is like the brothel, basically. You know, why not? I'm never keen on the targets, you know, in killing them. Nothing really feels right. You know, I like the alternative outcome there, where, you know, you can basically make them anonymous and send them down to work in mines and things like that. But, yeah, they don't really give me anything as a mission. I just like the architecture of that level, you know, and just the design of it all and the approach to it, which there's a lot of like high areas and then medium height areas and like that, and just having to really use that verticality on coming in and just finding the little nooks and crannies to get in. It's just one of the most fun ones to sort of explore ways to get in and around like that. You know, it's one of those that I find is the most adaptable as an assassination mission. But yeah, just a shame that, you know, I don't really care for the targets, and really your main target there is to get Emily. That's, you know, that they kind of feel like a secondary thing there. But hey, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, you know, I think that while the original Dishonored could definitely do a better job of, I suppose, characterizing or maybe reinforcing the importance of why you have to take out these specific targets, right? I don't think that's ever necessarily emphasized as well as it could be or as impactfully as it could be. But I think that with all of the missions, for the most part, you know, the amount of variety, or I suppose options, and with which you can ascertain information from people, or just, you know, from your own exploration, I was still really, really impressed with on this playthrough. You know, thinking about the twins assassination that you mentioned at the Golden Cat, right? The fact that, you know, you can randomly explore that brothel, and then you find, you know, there's this one little memorable set piece where you find a guy that's blindfolded, that's strapped to basically an electric chair, and he's expecting like his mistress or whatever to come over and like shock him for, you know, gratification. And the fact that, you know, you can basically extract information from him by torturing him. And then, you know, part of it is up to the player, to, you know, how far are you going to take that? Are you going to kill him, or are you going to do it just enough so you can get that vital piece of information, which sends you then out of the brothel to another location that then will, you know, eventually give you a piece of information for this hit and for even a later hit.
Yeah.
You know, that leads to the Lady Boyle's party, where, you know, you have to suss out which one of the three sisters is the actual target. And the fact that each one of them has a different personality, on top of the fact it's a different sister every single playthrough. But again, there's three or four ways in which you can infiltrate that party. One of them is very simplistic. It's introduced as soon as you walk up to the venue. But in the previous mission, if you went out of your way to explore all these different avenues and whatnot, you already have a means of an invitation. And so I think that for me, like, that speaks to the replayability of Dishonored in a way that I think, you know, I'm on record as being somebody that does not necessarily replay a great deal of games, even games like this that offer that, you know, the randomized nature of some missions and whatnot. But like the Dishonored games, in addition to something like Prey, I view those as being games that are still not maybe getting the amount of credit they deserve for how replayable they are, because of the amount of depth that are in these worlds and in these environments. Even in a game, when you come back to Prey, where it's like, Dishonored, where it's broken up into sections. It's not this continuous world. You could play these missions three or four times as soon as you complete them.
Yeah.
Every single time, if you go out of your way, you can find something new and exciting, whether it's pertaining to the hit itself, whether it's pertaining to something you learn about the world, or even if it's just, you know, scrounging for all those bone charms and rooms that then will allow the player to be able to upgrade their abilities in a way that, you know, will influence how they approach the next hit and whatnot. And it's one of those games where it's like, the longer I'm in that world, the more I want to try new things, the more I want to take risks. And it's not just for the typical, you know, I suppose, monetary reward that games typically will give players. It feels like a better understanding of the world itself, the mechanics, and how to approach my future hits, even when I don't even know what those will entail. And I think that, you know, throwing in every once in a while one of these hits where it was the Royal Physician, I believe, you can't assassinate that target. You have to neutralize him, and then you have to carry his body out while he's unconscious. And like, one of those, getting a mission like that in between, you know, just kind of running through and assassinating the previous two or three targets, again, it fundamentally alters the way that I approach that mission, because all of a sudden I have to be more cognizant of, okay, there's no lethality in this one for the target. I need to think about my exit strategy as much as I am diving right into the fray of things and, you know, actually reaching the target.
Yeah, it does just end up giving you such fun in those final moments, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, in terms of like the later missions, there's one where you return to the tower from the beginning of the game where, you know, Corvo observes that assassination of, you know, his charge and whatnot. And like, getting to return to an environment in a game sometimes is one of those eye rolling things where it's like, oh, okay, we're going back to the beginning. This is going to be exactly what I expected it to be because of what it was earlier. But like, getting to return to that environment with what the player has learned, but then being faced with even more threats in terms of, you know, the amount of enemies, but also like the layout is slightly different because of the fortifications that have been put up all of a sudden due to the occupation. Like, that just makes for one of those great late stage challenges that is recycling, but at the same time, like reinventing, which I think, again, speaks to just that replayability.
Yeah, it's just endlessly replayable, almost not because it's got some special loop that makes it like that, you know, where in the sense of like a multiplayer game that might have that. It's the same thing that keeps me coming back to like the modern Hitman games, you know, Metal Gear Solid 5, you know, games I've spent hundreds of hours on, because they cut the things down, you know, into these sections, and give you so much to do in them. You know, the very definition of a sandbox, you know, in terms of like you can do so many things to get to the point you want to get to. And you know, even in points in this game, you know, where you can just kind of be there, you know, like the Lady Boyle mission, where you can just be there, infiltrate it. You know, that's very reminiscent of a Hitman Blood Money mission, you know, in terms of how it works out. So at the time, that was like, you know, the mission that stood out for me, and like, I don't mind doing the stealth stuff, but it just feels like you feel pressured to do that the certain way, and to actually have a mission where you can kind of chill and observe and that be the point of the mission. Yeah, perfect sort of example. It was definitely the mission that really made the game click with me, you know, I think, because it was a very different kind of immersive sim to sort of say, you know, Deus Ex Mankind, Human Revolution. So it's a game that I thought was very good when it came out, appreciated later, much like with the sequel, where I didn't actually like it that much at first. It took coming back to it and it getting in that loop of like, I've done it once, now I'm going to do it again and again and again. And my appreciation for that game and Prey, you know, especially, and then Deathloop, made me come back to this time and really just like the nitty-gritty of it, and just how raw the ingredients are, and how, yeah, you could pick holes in certain aspects of it now because of what they've gone on to do since. Mm. But I think, yeah, it's just like the ambition is there, you know, and it's just really well realized, and it's nice to see how everything in here still echoes through, even in Redfall. You know, I think, you know, there are aspects of in every single Arkane game since that really show the core design work here that made it such a successful game. And while those games have got more divisive the further they've gone out from it, I think that's probably because they each changed something different, you know, each time from that original idea. So yeah, that just Arkane, it's lovely when you keep looking at these things and go, yeah, they've really got it. I think the key is keep it in space, keep it in Europe, so that, and you're fine. Which is why the Blade game would be great. So, I mean, that for me is very interesting going forward. I mean, since we last did an Arkane episode, you know, Redfall, we've obviously learned of this Blade game and the fact that it is set in Paris and it's going to be, you know, third person. Which is very intriguing, you know, to a third, because like I just mentioned, you know, Metal Gear Solid 5 and Hitman show that, yeah, you can do immersive sim style stuff in that kind of way, but, you know, the Arkane way, I'm really excited to see how they take their fundamentals and shift them to a third person. It sounds like it'd be simple, you know, game, different camera, whatever, but it really does change the way that works, you know. So, and especially with Blade, you know, that's got to be more combat focused than I'd imagine earlier games have been.
Yeah, you know, I think that one thing we didn't chat about, which, you know, I guess there isn't a terrible amount to say, is just like with a game such as Dishonored, the one thing that always kind of stood out to me as being maybe a sticking point, even if that. It's the thing where it's like when you're in first person, you know, while it's of course on the player to have their head on a swivel at all times, first person can be very limiting in that regard when it comes to stealth, right? So how do you go from the transition of first person in stealth to third person in stealth without that feeling like the ultimate stealth cheat code, if you will, right? The fact that all of a sudden, oh, well, stealth is so easy because I've got 360 degree view of everything. And so, at the same time, though, with a studio like Arkane, it's like I don't have a worry in terms of like how they are going to bridge that transition because of the fact that they are a studio that's proven time and time again they can have innovation to make an experience, you know, very singularly their own brand of stealth and whatnot. And, you know, with something like Blade, as you mentioned, you know, it's going to be this thing where it's like finding a balance between an immersive sim quality, but also a brand or an IP that is a lot more sort of situated for combat encounters and large scale combat encounters at that. But I think that, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, at the same time, I'm going to show up day one for Blade regardless, just because of their attention to very hyper specific art styles that are tied to either a period or a locale. And I think that that's one of those aspects of the Blade game that is very unknown at the moment, but at the same time, it's probably the most intriguing and exciting, seeing how they're going to apply their very specific artistic sensibilities to something like Blade. You know, what very little we've seen of that game seemingly will be shown off in a way that, you know, was not cognizant in the films and, you know, the comics and whatnot. So that'll be exciting to see how that develops.
Yeah. And then you've got the other side of it, which is, you know, Wolfeye Studios, which is obviously run by Rafael Colantonio, who made this game. You know, they did Weird West, which was like an isometric immersive sim, and that was amazing how that worked out. And now their next game is going to be, you know, a retro sci-fi style first person immersive sim. Yeah. Which is like, well, it's like if one thing doesn't work out for you, there's another. So, you know, that's a great benefit of what's happened, you know, like that, to, you know, especially for Raphael, who's obviously been there with Arcane right from the beginning with Arx Vitalis and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, two great games in terms of like anticipation and proof, I think, that, you know, Redfall, as we said at the time, very much feels like a by committee sort of problem more than anything first. So yeah, I'm very intrigued because Dinga Kappa, I've probably mispronounced his name now saying that, but yeah, him handling Deathloop, and that was great. Again, Divisive, and then obviously that team are very much the focus with Blade and Raphael and Wolfeye just being doing that, something that's going to be very, you know, very much a typical sort of Arcane game. Yeah, future's bright, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot to look forward to in terms of, you know, down the horizon. But at the same time, I think in revisiting Dishonored and kind of getting a better appreciation for it on my first replay, might have to cover Dishonored 2 in the near future, because it's one of those things where it's like, I only ever made it to that Clockwork House that's ever shifting and whatnot, and then never finished the game because, you know, as usual, got distracted by one thing or another. I think at this point, I just need to blame my moving on from things to my ADHD, but it's one of those things where it's like, just made me even more excited to see what they learned from the original Dishonored going into the sequel, and, you know, what they retained, what, and seeing what they evolved on kind of has me excited to dive into that. So who knows, maybe we'll dive into Dishonored 2 in the future, but in the immediate future, we can say that next week we're going to be chatting about the brand new Alone in the Dark game, which, you know, we earlier in the month covered the original Alone in the Dark, and that was the only one that I'd played. And so I'm really excited to kind of dive into this modern reboot. As we mentioned, is helmed by the previous writer from Frictional Games is leading that. And then, you know, you and I have been playing that periodically over the last few weeks. So yeah, really excited to dive into that next week and more. But until then, my friend, it's a pleasure chatting horror with you for Safe Room.
Back at you. Until the next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Safe Room. If you enjoy the show, please rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Safe Room Pod for show updates. As always, our main episodes for Safe Room drop every Monday, but our bite-sized episodes of Horror Bites, our indie horror showcase, drop every Thursday. You can follow Horror Bites' Twitter account at horrorbites_SR. You can join our Discord channel, Safe Room Podcast, to chat with us and other horror fans about the genre we all love. And finally, you can send emails to saferoompod@gmail.com if you'd like to share your thoughts on a game we have or are going to cover. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you guys next Monday.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.